Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, you're about to hear from Rahama Bistritsky Clapman, who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rahama Bistritsky Clapman here on Deb Brenner's Talk Line Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rahama and Family Matters.
Good evening and welcome back to Family Matters, MASC's weekly radio show. MASC, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. We have a helpline, we offer support groups, we're a referral agency. We're in our 20th year with over 45,000 families that have gone through our programs. MASC is available from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Confidential helpline at 718-758-0400. And tonight we have with us Dr. Eli Shapiro from the Digital Citizenship Project. Welcome, Dr. Eli.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Is it okay if I call you Dr. Ellie?
That's great.
Okay, because I know you since you were Ellie.
Yeah.
So many years. Wow, and I've watched you turn into a digital citizenship specialist. I'd like to talk tonight about technology with Dr. Ellie. And technology, there are good parts to technology, and then there are those not so wonderful parts of the technology. And we are going to have Dr. Eli Shapiro discuss the different issues that come with technology. There are national studies. There are different issues in reference to cyberbullying, emailing, texting, and then what MASC also is so concerned about always is the accidental issues that come up innocently when one can be on the internet. So I'm going to give it over to Dr. Eli Shapiro to first. Can you tell us about Digital Citizenship Project, please?
Thank you. So when we started the Digital Citizenship Project, a lot of the issues we were seeing in the community was about the content of the internet, and we were seeing the intervention for that primarily being filters. And in my work, I was seeing more and more challenges around the areas of how technology is impacting social functioning, psychological functioning, behavioral functioning. And our goal with the Digital Citizenship Project was to create a program where kids and parents can learn about how technology impacts them with the goal of developing a balanced and healthy digital lifestyle.
So you're saying parents and children, but at MASC, we also deal with adults, and adults can also fall into negative issues with when it comes to the computers.
So it really, it's not just about the computers, and it's not so much just about negative issues. We see a lot around the social realm, how people are interacting with one another, how today people make eye contact significantly less than they used to. And eye contact is a critical component of developing meaningful connections and positive relationships. And so these are some of the areas we want to focus on. Psychologically, we see a strong correlation, not just what our work, but the research indicates that there's a strong correlation between anxiety and subjective well-being, depression, happiness. People that are more engaged with their technology tend to have higher levels of anxiety and people who have higher levels of anxiety also tend to be more at risk to develop unhealthy relationships with their technology.
Interesting. One, what you mentioned about eye contact. I once visited a friend, and when I got to her home, there were three girls sitting on the couch. One her daughter with two friends, one on each side. They were all three on their cell phones texting. And I said, wow, you guys really look busy. And it really looked like intense. And they looked up and I go, what's going on? And they go, we're just texting each other. And they're sitting next to each other and not talking. So that's a very big concern also to many people.
So, you know, it's interesting because it's very similar. I call it a regression to parallel play. You know, in preschoolers, the kids play together but side by side. And so we're seeing that amongst adolescents, and we're seeing that amongst adults as well. There was an interesting study in 2014 out of UCLA where they measured children's ability. These were middle schoolers. They measured their ability to read social cues and facial expressions, and then they sent them to camp. And in this particular camp, there was no technology. And it's a big debate today whether to allow cell phones in camp or other technology. In this particular study with UCLA, they did not allow technology in camp. And they measured the children's abilities to read social cues and facial expressions after 5 days. And what they found was that there was a marked improvement in the children's ability to connect with one another. They were better equipped to read social cues, make understand facial expressions, and form meaningful connections, more meaningful connections than they were forming prior to the technology. So what that tells us really is twofold. One is that technology is having a negative impact on our social connectivity, and two, that it's reparable. We can change that. We can take breaks from technology, targeted breaks, deliberative breaks, in order to establish meaningful connections. We actually go out with a group of friends every once in a while, and we have a rule, a lot of people do this, is you pile up your cell phones in the middle of the table, and the first person that grabs their cell phone has to pay for dinner. And so that's something that we do. We actually have one friend that can't keep his hands off his cell phone, so we make sure to invite him every time, and dinner has been covered for the past long while. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is, you know, when kids connect, there's something called online disinhibition. Psychologist John Seller identified this in about 2006. And online disinhibition is the increased likelihood that we're going to do or say something online that we wouldn't normally do or say in a face-to-face conversation. So for many kids, it's just much easier to communicate via text. Kids who have social anxiety or elevated levels of anxiety are concerned about self-image and how people are going to interpret what they say, find it much easier to communicate through the digital realm. And one of the reasons that they're using that more frequently is just because it becomes easier. That could be a positive, you know, as you said in your opening remarks, that when it comes to technology, there's both positive and negative. Some of the positive is that people with real social anxiety that can't connect and can't communicate have this benefit that they can communicate through technology without that anxiety. On the other hand, it also allows us to do and say things that we wouldn't normally do or say in a face-to-face conversation. There's a lot of research on children on the spectrum of autism that technology, communicating through technology, is actually very good for them because they have such a difficult time in the real world that this gives them a great opportunity to connect socially. On the other hand, if we're losing that face-to-face quality connectivity, that might be a problem. We don't want to become dependent on our technology. And that's why we talk about having a balanced digital lifestyle.
Wow, so much to talk about this evening with Dr. Ellie Shapiro. And if anybody wants to reach Dr. Ellie Shapiro, you can call 718-758-0400 between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. at MASC. And we will give you his information. Anyone that wants to go on to his website, you can go on www.thedigitalcitizenship.com. So let's get down to numbers here. You know, at MASC, we really don't give out, you know, our survey information that often. But I think it's important that we talk about your survey that you did not long ago, Dr. Shapiro. And that is for nearly 700 students, 6th to 8th grade from yeshiva and day schools. So I know that you had said that out of the 700 students, 17% were cyberbullied, 38% either emailed or texted something and regretted it later, and 47% accidentally ended up on objectionable websites. So let's start with cyberbullying. Can we talk about the dangers for our parents that are listening tonight about cyberbullying? What's going on with cyberbullying? Because not everybody knows, not every parent has a computer, but kids do have cell phones, and parents don't all have smartphones. Some kids get their own smartphones, and they're not even aware that their kids are being cyberbullied, and the kids react to it in so many different ways, eating disorders, anxieties. You're the doctor. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, so let's first define cyberbullying, because sometimes I start talking about it and then someone raises their hand. Any questions, someone raises their hand, what is cyberbullying? So we're more familiar with the traditional school-based bullying where you have in any given classroom environment one or two chronic bullies and one or two chronic victims. And generally, most people end up being bystanders in those situations. What cyberbullying is really taking the mean or cruel behavior or the exclusionary type behavior that you might see in a school environment and bringing it to the digital realm. What makes that really difficult is that, as we mentioned before about this idea of disinhibition, people are more likely to do or say things that they wouldn't do or say in a face-to-face conversation. It really gives more people the potential to be cyber bullies and cyber victims than we would see in a traditional school-based environment. Additionally, any given act of cyberbullying, it's really impossible to measure what the impact is, or there's no way to really pull it back. So if you post a picture of someone making fun of them, you know, saying, look how stupid this person looks in the picture, you may send it out with one click, but you don't know how many times it's being reposted or sent. And even if you pull down your post, it doesn't mean that it has gone away. And so just to go back to the statistics for a second, the data that you referenced was collected in 2015, 2016. We've actually been conducting data, not just about cyberbullying, but about technology as a whole in Jewish day schools across the United States. We have about 1,500 student surveys and about 600 parent surveys from really communities all across the United States, representing a wide cross-section of the community. And what's really interesting is that we've seen the rates of cyberbullying going up in the middle school population. My first collection, my dissertation, was actually on cyberbullying amongst Jewish day school students. And in my first data collection, we had about 12% of students reporting that they'd been cyberbullied in the past 6 months. In this 2015-2016 data study that you referenced, it was at about 17%. Last year, we had seen numbers as high as 35% of kids reported being cyberbullying. So what we're seeing is an upward trajectory of it, most likely due to the increased proliferation of devices amongst middle school students. We've been collecting data primarily from middle school students, some high school students as well, but this increase from the 17 to the 25 to the 35 really has to do with more accessibility, more availability to the kids. Interestingly enough, the point you made is that parents might not be aware of it. We often see in technology-related issues big discrepancies between what kids are reporting and what parents are reporting. So if we're seeing about 35% now of middle schoolers reported being cyberbullied, maybe about 10% of parents will say that their children have been cyberbullied. We see that across the board with technology. You know, we ask the question, have you spoken with your child about safe and responsible ways of using technology? The parents at about 80 to 85% say they have, and the kids about 40% say that they have. So, you know, it is interesting that paradigm, that perspective difference between parents and kids. We refer to it as digital immigrants and digital natives. But more importantly, as it comes to cyberbullying, the impact can really be tremendous. And the shift between being a cyber bully and a cyber victim or a bystander and becoming a bully online is very quick. A lot of times kids don't think that when they just click the like button or forward a picture that that is actually cyberbullying, but it actually is. You're causing harm to another person via the digital realm. And our goal at Digital Citizenship Project is to educate kids about many issues around technology, cyberbullying being one of them.
So you're talking about parents that aren't even aware. Okay, so we really then touch on parental control settings and how they're activated. Can we talk more about the safety, the filter for the tablets, the internet, the cell phones? Can we talk about the safety part that parents that are listening tonight may not even be aware of?
So we've been hearing a lot about filters and parental oversight when it comes to technology, monitoring software, filters. And the filters and monitoring software are about as good as the parenting is. The filters in and of themselves don't really make much of a difference when for kids who are going to look something up or accidentally end up on a website their parents would disapprove of or be disturbed by images. It's really about parents speaking with their kids and educating the kids and having clear rules and guidelines. Our data, as well as other data, Haifa University did a study on this and found that the filters in and of themselves were pretty ineffective. But when parents speak with their children and have set rules and guidelines and the parental expectations are made clear, kids do a lot better. Now, of course, you have to have the filter. The filter is a must. But unfortunately, many parents just rely on the filter and leave the parental role out of it. I like to say that the filter changes the device, but our goal is to change the child. And we've seen really positive numbers and impact from parents that are engaged with the kids when it comes to technology and discussing that. We found that about 57% of kids have seen images or videos, clips that have disturbed them. And these are, again, our middle schoolers. So 57% is the majority of kids. And when we ask parents, it's below 20%. Below 20% of parents say that my kids have been disturbed, but more than 57% say my kids have been disturbed by content. And so it is interesting that there is that disconnect. Additionally, with all that said about filters, the percentage of parents of kids that report that their parents have put filters or any sort of parental software, monitoring software on the devices is actually pretty low. It's an average of about 35% from the data we've collected. It's a little more in some communities, a little less in others, but middle schoolers, about 65% of middle schoolers have personal devices that have no parental software on it.
So if we were just beginning with young kids, first, second, third, fourth graders, if parents were to discuss in front of those young kids the issue of safe technology, that's what you're saying the biggest impact will be. The younger we speak to them about technology and safety ways of being on the technology, that's the more cooperation you can get as they get older. But starting a conversation with ninth grader or an eighth grader, isn't that more difficult to make changes?
Yeah, it's very difficult to retrofit. I often, when I speak in communities, I hear from parents that say, oh my gosh, I've been doing this all wrong for the past, number of years. How do I change it? The best way to approach it, and really, in speaking to kids, that's only one piece of it. The most significant impact is how parents model their own digital citizenship. If it's difficult to tell a child you're spending too much time on a screen, when as a parent, you're on the screen all the time as well. It's important that parents model good digital citizenship, put their phones down. One of the examples we give is about before going to bed. Numerous studies indicate that the screen time before bed has a negative impact on sleep cycles, and sleeping with your device within reach has a negative impact on sleep, particularly amongst adolescents. And so speaking with them about how it impacts sleep and communicating with them and modeling and saying, hey, we're all going to not utilize our devices a half hour before bed or an hour before bed or whatever it might be, not only is a good modeling for the kids at any age, but when you're trying to retrofit for an adolescent, the idea of taking a family approach to technology, because at this point, kids have their own devices, they've had them for a while, and taking a family approach to technology, like going dark for dinner. When it's dinner time at home, everybody puts their devices away. Or now that we understand how technology or screen time impacts sleep, the parents as well, are going to shut our devices down an hour before bed. I know many families have central charging stations, so all the devices. So yeah, you're correct that on the high school level, it is more difficult and it should really be more of a family approach. But the truth is, even for the younger kids, parents should be modeling good digital citizenship and healthy technology behaviors as well.
We have Dr. Ellie Shapiro from the digitalcitizenship.com program. Dr. Ellie, we're talking about keeping phones now by your bedside. 56% sleep with their cell phones within reach. That's a very large number. That's more than half. Isn't it so that people that do sleep with their cell phones nearby get to go to bed later, wake up in the middle of the night, will check the phones? I know kids, 60% of your survey, 700 students, said that they go to bed later as a result of their technology.
So I actually want to correct that statistic. The 56% of kids that sleep with their cell phones within reach are of the total survey.
Right.
A number of the kids don't have cell phones.
Right.
So
right.
Let me correct that statistic, which is that it's about 83% of students that have cell phones or internet capable devices sleep with them within reach. So really, almost all the kids that have cell phones or internet capable devices sleep with them within reach. There's a number of reasons why cell phones disturb sleep cycles. There's a study out of Harvard University where they compared reading a book before going to bed and reading an e-reader before going to bed. So forget the cell phone a second. So what Harvard found was, and I don't think it's a secret for anyone, when you open up a book when you're going to sleep, how long does it take you to fall asleep? It's pretty instant.
I think the first page, the third sentence sometimes.
Yeah, I've been reading the same book for 6 years, and it's only an 80-page book. So but what they found with the e-reader was that people had more difficulty falling asleep, and the quality of their sleep was also diminished. It was a lesser quality sleep. So that really has to do with the light and impacting melatonin production in the brain. What it does is it tricks the brain into thinking that it's daytime. So shutting down the devices before bedtime is really important. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is that it's something called FOMO. For those of the parents out there that might not be so literate in that.
I'm so glad you brought up FOMO, because when I was outside one day with some friends right in front of the house, one of the girls mentioned, I feel so FOMO. And I said, what is FOMO? I really didn't know what FOMO was. So, can you explain what FOMO is for some of our listeners that are maybe my age?
Yeah, so FOMO is the fear of missing out. And really, the fear of missing out is what promotes a lot of the anxiety amongst kids. If they have grade level chats or group chats, they're concerned that if they miss a comment or they miss something, that they've missed out on something significant. That really leads to the anxiety. A lot of the anxiety also leads to a lot of the compulsivity that we see of kids checking their devices very frequently or impulsively commenting on something to be the first one to make the comment, et cetera. But what that does, the anxiety is a daytime thing. But what happens at night is when the device is next to their bed, they are concerned that they're going to miss something. So they stay up till 1, 2, 3 in the morning just because they might miss something. There's an interesting study where they found that 89% of adults experience something called phantom vibrations. Phantom vibrations is when your body is vibrating, but your phone is not there.
Oh my
the
goodness.
Body has literally been conditioned to anticipate the buzz, anticipate the phone call or the email, et cetera. And so kids have been conditioned to see what the next text is, what the next pop-up is, what the next comment is. And so they are checking their devices. And that desire, that fear of missing out, that conditioning does not change when they go to sleep. So if they have their phone right next to them in bed, not only are they going to have a hard time falling asleep because of the actual screen, but they are also going to have a hard time because they're anticipating that next buzz. They don't quite get the good night's sleep that they actually need. And parents that are concerned about their children's academic performance, quality sleep is one of the greatest indicators for a good academic performance. So helping our kids get to sleep is important. And one of the things that I've done with a number of schools in communities around the country has been to help them establish with the parents curfews for cell phones. So what the nice part about that is, let's say you're a sixth grader. Let's go with an eighth grader. Let's say you're an eighth grader and 80% of the kids have devices and there's a grade level chat, et cetera. The best thing we can do for them is to have all the parents on that grade level chat agree that at 10 o'clock or 9:30 or 10:30, the time is less important than the actual action, is that everyone in the class is going to shut down their devices. What that does is it eliminates the FOMO, and it really ends up being a real gift to the kids because they don't have that anxiety. They don't have that worry that they're missing out on something because everybody in the grade is doing it. And so that's one of the approaches that we take to helping our kids get a good night's sleep and helping to reduce the anxiety they experience is by coming up with uniform rules amongst the grade itself. Really, that has to be a parent-driven approach, and we work with schools and with parent communities to help them achieve that.
Dr. Ellie, there's so much danger on the internet. Let's go towards the dangerous part. Because as a result of being exposed to graphic content, it can really be a permanent image on one's mind. So I know your main focus is to educate parents on using technology safely in children, young adults. But what happens when, I'd like you to describe what happens. I know what happens from all my clients, but I'd like you to discuss professionally what can be the result of a young adult or anyone seeing pornography on the internet by mistake, simply putting in a word, Googling, surfing the web something, and something very, very negative for a young adult or even someone married to see. I know how many clients call us with these issues on a daily basis. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, please.
The actual exposure rates are fairly interesting. What we found in our data is that 57% of kids report being disturbed by online content, which is really interesting because it's not just that they were exposed to something. The kids are reporting that they found it disturbing, which means that it had a negative emotional impact on them. Again, I would say probably 80% of kids have been exposed to something, but 57% are reporting that they have been they've had a negative emotional reaction to it. It is problematic. What's really interesting, there's been a lot of focus on the issues of pornography, but what I've actually been seeing from the kids being more disturbed is by graphic violence. Amazingly enough, we have a certain cultural acceptance to graphic violence. Even in, I would say I have a shul WhatsApp group and people sometimes put pictures of dead terrorists up. Now, I find that imagery very disturbing. And this is something that no filter is going to block. Because if my cell phone is on the counter and my child picks up the cell phone and is scrolling through what should be my safe shul WhatsApp group, and sees this graphic imagery, it's very disturbing. The videos that come out, the proliferation of video recording devices, videos come out of Iraq in the past, or ISIS more currently, really horrific imagery that really can scar children and scar adults as well. And so these two pieces, graphic imagery, can have both an immediate negative impact on children's functioning, as well as for a percentage of people, long-term negative impacts on their relationships, on intimacy. It's hard to explain why some people really struggle with this in the same way that's hard to explain why some people struggle with addiction. There may be biological predisposition. There may be addictive tendencies when it comes to how content stimulates the brain. But certainly, the earlier the exposure is, the more problematic. Similar with substance abuse, the age of onset becomes a predictor for addictive and negative behaviors later on. And so helping our kids early on when they see something that they shouldn't be seeing. And again, this goes back to the education and not just the filtering, because the filter, something gets through the filter and you haven't taught them what the next step is, what to do. It's not so effective. But if you teach your children that if something comes up that is disturbing to you or that you think mommy and daddy wouldn't approve of, close the window immediately and come tell us. So we have to give our children those tools to know what to do when it happens.
Can you also give some language for the parents to respond to their child once they do come and share with them? Because our listeners want practical guidance, practical advice on what they can respond when faced with some issues. And many times our listeners are invited to big symposiums and events, and we offer them speakers both at MASC and other organizations do in the community. And the main thing people say at the end of some of these programs, when the other organizations, we sit together, we collaborate on events, one main comment always is, okay, you spoke about the problem, now give us some answers. So if you can offer to my listeners tonight, what would be some of the responses, if you can give 2-3 examples of what a child may come and feel safe enough to share with their parents and say, I saw something inappropriate, I saw something graphic, what would be the conversation like?
So the first thing is sort of what not to do.
You can do that too. Yeah. You can share with our listeners that too.
What not to do is freak out. Our children, oftentimes, you know, when your child's running and then when they're young and they're like 3 and they're running and they fall and they scrape their knee, they will, before they start crying, they will first look to their parents to see what their parents' reaction is before they respond. And if the parent has a horrified look and a fearful look and an incredible degree of concern, the children will usually respond in kind. And it's similar when they come to you with these sort of issues or other life challenges, or they crash the car. You know, these issues that kids have in life, how you respond initially is really is critical. So what not to do is not to freak out, not to yell, not to scream. I think the first thing is that I'm so proud of you that you knew what to do, or I'm so happy that you came to me and we can talk about this. And let's figure out a way that, you know, we can help avoid this happening again. But I'm so proud that you came to me and discussed it.
Great statement, because we react so, you know, on impulse, we'll just go to fixing it. So by first acknowledging it is such an important statement.
Yeah, acknowledging it, validating it, making our kids feel good about the decision they made so that they will do it again, that they will come to us when things happen again.
And in other areas, they'll feel they can come to them.
100%. But, you know, I was going to get to that. This doesn't just happen in isolation. It's something that if we've been communicating with our kids for a while about technology, it makes the conversation that much easier. What I've experienced in many communities, I will ask groups of parents, your child comes home from school and you ask them, how was your day? What do they say? Fine. And then you follow up with, what did you do today? And what did they say?
Regular.
Yeah, regular, nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. And so that's usually the extent of the conversations. And our goal is to promote healthy conversations amongst parents and kids. So we teach parents how to engage in dialogue, open-ended questions. Tell me about your day. Who'd you sit next to in school today? What did you learn today? When we do family dinner at home when we go dark for dinner, and this is during the weekday, no devices. My kids are not allowed to get up from the table until they've told me something that they learned today in school. And so that's a process that we engage in. And so by starting to have the innocuous conversations, by really focusing on parent-child communication, then these conversations, when it comes to decision-making or substance abuse or digital technology, they're that much easier. You know, today we're here talking about digital technology, and I know MASC covers so many issues, but the interventions are very similar from a parental perspective. Being an engaged parent, being a good communicator with your kids, really listening to what your kids have to say is really one of the biggest preventative measures for a lot of the issues you deal with, whether it's digital technology issues or substance abuse or self-harm, et cetera. And so parents that want more practical solutions, I think, can reach out to MASC. It's something that you do very well, and you make those referrals. And parents can also go to the website, www.thedigitalcitizenship.com.
Thank you. And we're with Dr. Ellie Shapiro from thedigitalcitizenship.com. Dr. Ellie, can we talk about the professional development part of your organization? You do education in schools. You do community lectures. You work with the curriculum and workshops in the student education part. And you do data collection and analysis with your research. So I know that you travel around the world. Can you talk about what is the difference when you talk to parents with their children sitting next to them, or talking to parents alone and children alone?
So our approach at the Digital Citizenship Project is really threefold. You know, in social work, we have something called systems theory and the different systems that impact family dynamics and individual functioning. Our goal is to educate parents, it's to educate children, and to educate the school faculty that spend a lot of time with the students. We want everybody to have the same language and be sensitized to awareness about how technology might be impacting their functioning. Because kids go to school and spend most of their day in school, it's really important for school faculty as well. So what we have done is we've developed a curriculum in digital citizenship. We train school faculty to run the curriculum, the modules in their classrooms, in their schools. And it focuses on a lot of what we talked about today: impulsivity, compulsivity, disinhibition, desensitization. All the issues that we talked about today, we want to give kids the language, as you mentioned, the language on how to communicate what it is they're experiencing. We want them to have a better self-awareness of their own experiences with technology in order to make more healthy and more responsible decisions with technology. So that's one piece of it. The parent education, of course, goes along as well. And we want to dovetail the work we do with students with the work that we do with parents. So when a child says, talks about disinhibition or compulsivity, the parents are using that same language as well. And the professional development that we do, we have two different levels of professional development. One is just a general awareness for teachers on how to be able to identify when a student might be having issues with technology in the classroom. And the other is training school personnel to run our curriculum in the classroom as well. And so helping the school identify this actually helps them work with students more effectively that might be having issues with technology. I was working with a student a while back who had a significant downturn in their academic performance. They came to school looking tired all the time, et cetera. And, while initially you might say maybe there's some trauma at home, or maybe there's some substance abuse going on, my first question was when meeting with the parent was, does your child have an iPad or a digital device? This was a sixth grader. And the mother said, oh, yeah, he has an iPad. He's on until 3-4 in the morning every night. So I suggested another, well, have you thought about, having a shut-off time for the iPad? And her response was, but it's his.
You're kidding.
Nope.
You're kidding.
No, this idea that it was the child's iPad and she couldn't take it away. But being able to identify that this was a technology-based issue versus any other issue, I think is something that school personnel need to be more sensitized to, that this might be an issue.
you know, talking about the schools, can we talk a little bit about the staff? What kind of trainings are you doing with the staffs?
So the staff, as I said, we have this overview, you know, of just the general awareness and helping them be aware of, again, how technology impacts social, psychological, and behavioral functioning, what the warning signs might be in the classroom, like children looking tired or, you know, changes in their academic performance or in their social engagement.
But what is their role?
Their role is to be aware and identify. They're in a better position oftentimes than parents to identify these challenges because they're seeing their children in a social environment and they're seeing them in their academic output environment.
But do you feel that they should then, it's their responsibility to notify the parent student by student?
Yeah, if they're seeing an issue around this, the idea is to be able to communicate with parents. And that's really why we developed this three-prong approach.
At what age would you say should the school, you know, is that fourth grade? What age, what class, what grade?
Well, for awareness, you can really start it at any grade. I actually spoke in a school in California that is a K through three school. It's a relatively new school, and they wanted to address technology from the parents' perspective and from the teacher's perspective early on, so that this is more of a preventative model than an intervention model.
Isn't that the most effective way to deal with technology? You know, going forward, now we know what it is. We know the negative impact it can make on some kids. We have clients that are now 21 years old, 18 years old, 17 years old, where they say that they saw graphic, you know, whether it's graphic or pornography, one time, and it affected them so that they ended up on drugs and they didn't do well in school, like you mentioned earlier. And the parents only found that out now, when they're 17, 19, 21 years old. So isn't our best prevention route to go is talking about it early on, school, parent, and then children, the three prong as early as K through third grade?
So we recommend from the parent and teacher's perspective at every age to start becoming aware and identifying where the issues might be. From educating the kids, we've actually found that until middle school, kids don't have the self-awareness of their own behavior. So middle school is really a great age because you have both parental oversight and a higher degree of self-awareness. Above middle school, as you mentioned, high school, there's a lot less parental opportunity to influence children's behaviors. And below middle school, the early childhood or elementary school, it's really more about the parents than it is about the kids. But certainly educating them across the board. So like I mentioned, that school was a K through three school, but every school that I speak at, I recommend parents from K through eight being invited to the lectures. High school parents, it's really a different strategy. Because that retrofitting piece, but certainly from a K through eight perspective, you know, we speak to parents across those ages. And we see also preschoolers being able to navigate an iPad sometimes more effectively than their parents can. So the kids are using technology. One of the challenges that we see is a parental denial a little bit that if the child doesn't own their own device, they must not be on it that much. But I see babies in strollers, you know, 1.5, 2 years old with an iPad or an iPhone, holding it, watching. And so that screen time, that engagement, you know, creates issues as early as preschool.
I see when I take my grandchildren to the park, I see kids sitting there swiping. I don't think they're 1.5 yet, you know, yeah. 2 years old, sitting in the carriage with a cell phone, with an iPad, they're swiping. I mean, we're talking very, very young. So isn't there like some research about that? So young, being on the computer screen, on the telephone at such a young age?
So there is research that excessive screen time is unhealthy for a variety of reasons. This whole technology research piece is a relatively new field. And there are no longitudinal studies, completed longitudinal studies that I'm aware of, that look at how technology has impacted kids long term. There is a study, I forget the woman's name, she's doing something called the Digitots study, and she's looking at kids that were born before 2007 and after 2007. What happened in 2007? The iPhone came out. This is only 10 years ago. So looking at how brain development is impacted by technology is a new field of study from a longitudinal perspective. What's interesting is some of the early findings are that gamers, for example, kids that play video games.
Oh, I'm really happy you brought up gamers because we didn't talk about that yet. That's so important. 58%, you said, in your survey, stay online to play games longer than they intended to. So thank you for bringing that.
Yeah, so I'll get to that statistic. That's actually important. That really relates to self-regulation. If kids are staying online and playing video games longer than they intended, it means they're not managing their own behaviors well. But what they found with gamers was that there were a whole host of skills that they excelled at compared to the non-gamers. They were better at problem solving. They were better at multitasking. They were better at drowning out external noise to focus on the task at hand. And so these are all benefits, and particularly as we move into more of a multitasking world, whether qualitatively multitasking is good or not is a separate issue. But we're moving in a world, we're living in a world that's moving towards a skill set that requires multitasking. So these gamers and these kids that are engaged with digital technology in high frequency, there is some benefit. But of course, we also know that there is some significant downside as well. And again, going back to this idea, we need to find that healthy balance. Anyone who tells you that we need to avoid technology or not engage in technology or not use technology is really not preparing kids to be functioning adults in this new digital age. We really have to educate kids, educate faculty, educate parents on how to help kids grow up in this digital era and manage their technology in a thoughtful and deliberative way as opposed to a compulsive, impulsive, and normative way. So video games aren't inherently bad. The content might be, but the gaming itself isn't inherently bad. And we need to help kids maximize that as well. Speaking of this new digital world and the requisite skills to be successful in it, we didn't talk about something called digital footprint. Digital footprint is the residue of your online activities that shape people's opinions that look into you in the online realm.
Yeah, that's a very important topic to bring up because I know employers are checking out people's Facebook pages and, like you said, their footprint. So that's a very, very important topic that we need to address now. We're with Dr. Ellie Shapiro on Masks radio show every Thursday night, Family Matters. And if you have a suggestion that you'd like us to interview, please call Mask 718-758-0400. I'm sorry. And Masks Helpline, we're a referral agency. We offer support groups for all mental health issues, school liaison, anyone that knows of a child that is not getting their admission cards for yeshivas, please call Masks so that we can help you try and get your child to the right person to have them go to school like all the children should go to school together at the beginning of the school year. So call Masks 718-758-0400. And also, Mask offers naloxone, Narcan, another form of Narcan. And that is for parents who would like to have a free kit in their home if their loved one is on any opiate for drug prevention of overdose. So call Mask. We'll train you. It's a very short training. We'll give you a free kit to take home. Call Mask at 718-758-0400. 00. And let's get back to Dr. Shapiro about the footprint, the issue of once you put something online, how it can stay there for longer than we as parents realize.
Yeah, so the digital footprint is really what the residue that we leave behind of our online activities, as well as what people say about us. And it's what people formulate their opinions, how people formulate their opinions about us by looking online. So when you post pictures, when you make negative comments, when you tweet or blog or basically put out negativity, it really affects how people look at you. Most recently, there was an article in the Harvard Crimson newspaper about 10 students that had their acceptance letters rescinded from Harvard for comments they made in a private Facebook group. So we have the freedom to say what we want, but people also have the freedom to make decisions about us, whether it's employers, whether it's colleges. And when you think about it, this group of students, this wasn't an impulsive group of students. These are kids who had 1,500 pluses on their SATs. They were tops of their respective classes. They had 99 grade averages. They had the most interesting and significant extracurricular activities. I mean, these were the top academic performers in the United States. To get into Harvard is not easy. And they got in, and their letters were rescinded for comments they made in a private Facebook group. So it's quite remarkable. And that was private. Imagine about all the content and information that you put out that could have an impact on your opportunities. People, I always get nervous when people talk about politics too strongly. You know, you may love Trump, you may hate Trump, but at the end of the day, if you're very vocal about it, you may have a job opportunity of someone who either loves Trump or hates Trump that might not happen because of your online comments. So your digital footprint, really, you need to be thoughtful and deliberative about what you put out there. And kids should have a goal of creating, not just avoiding a negative digital footprint, but really creating a positive one when it comes to opportunities and promoting charities or promoting good things or forwarding feel-good stories instead of negative ones. That all goes into shaping how people view you and what they look into when they look into you online.
So we are talking with Dr. Ellie Shapiro tonight. And Dr. Shapiro, your website, again, for our listeners, thedigitalcitizenship.com. So again, Dr. Ellie, artificial relationships, inconsistencies with the real world, ideas and values, these are things that people can use the internet for, and then there are good things that we can use it for, and that is schoolwork, having family across the ocean somewhere. So let's talk about some of the positive things so we can leave our listeners in a positive note, so we then can get encouraged to go onto your website, call Masks Helpline anonymously to reach Dr. Ellie Shapiro, 718-758-0400. Anyone that wants to help Masks continue with these radio shows, with the work we do out there in the community, in the yeshivas that we're in, all our programs, sponsor our helpline, please go on to www.maskparents.org and donate online. Be our partner. Let's save a life. There are 12 young adults that were nifter in the last 8-10 weeks. Shem Yishmar, Shem Yirachem. We need to get these all these different mental health topics out there. So please be our partner. Donate online at maskparents.org. Ellie, what would you like to say to our listeners before we end our show tonight?
So I'll just quote Charles Dickens, who in A Tale of Two Cities, he said it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. And I think if there ever was a time frame that we could say we're living in the age of wisdom and the age of foolishness, really now is it. We talked about some of the challenges that technology brings, the social, psychological, behavioral, the day-to-day impact, how it impacts career opportunities, college opportunities, shidduchim are impacted by it. But really, it's not just the age of foolishness, it is also the age of wisdom. We have tremendous opportunity that technology brings us when it comes to information, connectivity, productivity, just really the opportunity that we can record a radio show and bring important information anywhere in the world. We can record it anywhere in the world and we can send it anywhere in the world is quite remarkable. You mentioned that family across the sea, you know, the idea, you remember what a long distance call used to be?
Yes.
And now for really no cost at all, we can video chat with our family. The access to information is just unprecedented. There's really no excuse not to know something anymore. We just have to learn to be good consumers of online information. And so that really all goes back to the services that MASC provides, it's the services that Digital Citizenship provides. And our goal, like MASC, is to help people maximize their existential experiences. Ours, particularly in the area of digital technology, all the benefits that technology has to offer, by understanding how the negative impact of technology, so we can find a better, healthier, balanced digital lifestyle, as MASC also helps people find a better balanced existential lifestyle through whatever challenges. And so your work is really quite remarkable. People should continue to support you, to donate. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about how technology is impacting.
Thank you, Dr. Eli Shapiro. It was wonderful having you on. I hope to have you on again in the future. And like you said, technology can be great. I have all my Torah. I have Torah classes that I'm a part of. I have my Lakewood ride when I need it. I have my shidduchim, online. So my class, we have a class monthly Rosh Chodesh group. So there are wonderful things that we can do online for those that choose to be online. I'd like to thank you again, Dr. Shapiro, and thank our listeners, and hope to be with all of you next week again, Thursday night, 9 to 10. Thank you. Have a good night, and have a wonderful Shabbos.
KCN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
Are you sick of reality shows that aren't real at all and laugh tracks attempting to disguise the not-so-funny? Come to the fair. Disenchanted with the day-to-day? Come to the Renaissance Fair. Ready to make some amazing memories with your family, your partner, or your friends? Come to the New York Renaissance Fair. Step into our legendary realm where beautiful items are crafted by hand. Entertainers will surprise and play for you. And our feast of food will delightfully overwhelm you. Spend the day at the fair and know true adventure and excitement. Real people, real food, real fun. Live it up at the New York Renaissance Fair.
The New York Renaissance Fair, open Saturdays, Sundays, and Labor Day Monday, August 5th through October 1st in Sterling Forest, Tuxedo Park. Buy discount tickets at Walgreens and Duane Reade. Performance schedules and other info at renfair.com. Children admitted free this weekend. Coupons at renfair.com. R-E-N-F-A-I-R.com.
It's the perfect show for the summer. It's the perfect show for the whole family. And it's on stage now at the Westchester Broadway Theater, our amazing new production of the Tony Award winner, Annie. Annie, the story of the plucky little girl abandoned on the doorstep of an orphanage run by the evil Miss Hannigan in 1930s New York, who escapes to the wondrous world of New York City, encountering adventure after fun-filled adventure in the company of her lovable mutt, Sandy. The incredible score features memorable hits like It's a Hard Knock Life, Easy Street, I Don't Need Anything But You, and of course, that anthem of optimism, Tomorrow. And before every performance, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees, all for just $84, with special pricing for the kids. And you can even make advanced show-only reservations for just $50. You can call the box office at 914-592-2222. But for the fastest reservations, just visit our website at BroadwayTheater.com. Come and be a part of the family theater event of the year, Annie, on stage now at the Westchester Broadway Theater.